Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, June 1st, 2017. President Salva Kiir relinquishes his position as patron of the National Dialogue.
Now he has relinquished his patronage of this process because of the criticism that has come around and has left it free for us. He said, we the two-child person should see to it that we are the one going with it.
And South Sudanese staying at the largest African refugee camp say they are going hungry.
The food cannot reach at the end of the month, and we are 8 in the family. With this population of the family, it gives us hard times to get a substitute food. If you don't struggle, you will not get.
We'll have more on these stories on South Sudan in Focus. The chairman of the IGAD Assembly, who is also Prime Minister of Ethiopia, has written a letter to President Salva Kiir expressing concern over the worsening humanitarian situation in South Sudan and requesting a summit to discuss the matter later this month. South Sudan in Focus obtained a copy of the letter dated May 29, in which Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn invited President Kiir to attend a summit of IGAD leaders on June 12 in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Mr. Desalegn said, quote, "The escalation of violence and the growing hostilities are casting their shadows on the national dialogue and the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan," end quote. Desalegn calls on IGAD leaders to speak with one voice on South Sudan. SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar spoke to members of the Security Council yesterday via teleconference from South Africa, where Mr. Machar is reported to be under house arrest. There are no details of what he discussed with the Security Council members. SPLM-IO supporters posted a 5-page document on the social media today. South Sudan in Focus contacted Machar's office in South Africa for comment, but was told the SPLM-IO leader is banned from speaking to the media by the South African authorities. President Salva Kiir is no longer running the National Dialogue. The co-chair of the steering committee of the National Dialogue says President Kiir stepped away from his position as patron and the process is now in the hands of all South Sudanese. Mr. Kiir initiated the dialogue late last year, saying it would end the ongoing conflict and address other problems facing South Sudanese. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Many observers, both inside and outside the country, have criticized the president's decision to be patron of the national dialogue he announced in December. Beda says, when the president is swearing the more than 92-member steering committee late last month, he decided to step down from being patron so that the citizens would have more faith in the process.
Now he has relinquished his patronage of this process because of the criticism that has come around and has left it free for us. He said, we the two-child person should see to it that we are the one going with it and moving with it ahead.
Beda says he and Abil Alair, the other co-chair of the Dialogue Steering Committee, will open the process to all South Sudanese so that they can speak out honestly and without fear.
To talk about what is happening, to talk about the grievances all over among the 64 tribes, either with the government or among themselves. They are going to discuss the war. They are going to discuss the conflicts. They are going to discuss the killings, either for cattle rustling or for land, or the government army, which is supposed to protect us, is killing us.
Beda says the president has also taken other positive steps to create a conducive environment for the dialogue. He says changing the leadership of the army and the Ministry of Finance and releasing political detainees are all steps in the right direction. He says President Kiir should extend an invitation to rebel leader Riek Machar.
Although he has said Riek specifically should not come, we are not going to lose hope. There are many things he has said he will not do it, and he did it through persuasion.
Addressing religious leaders in Juba today, Beda said Faith groups have a key role to play in helping South Sudanese reconcile with themselves and heal their grievances. Reverend Apollo Alfred, Secretary General of the Africa Inland Church of South Sudan and Sudan, says religious leaders are more than happy to deliver the message of peace throughout South Sudan.
As soon as we go out from here, on Sundays we shall put the message of peace, the message of reconciliation, the message of unity, the message of oneness of this country, the same people, the same brothers and sisters. We need to stay together, united. We are South Sudanese. So if there is anything, we just share. We talk it over as a children of one family.
Joseph Marial, Director of Education at South Sudan's Islamic Council, says his faith also promotes peace and reconciliation.
We have so many verses talking about peace. Even the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a peace itself. We are within the grassroots. So we want our people to come together with our Christian brothers and other people who have no religion. So we want peace to in the whole country.
Roy Sampson, a member of Mothers Union at the Christian Brotherhood Church in South Sudan, says religious leaders should do their best to reach all the people of South Sudan, and the government should secure the states outside of Juba.
They say have to deliver the national dialogue to all areas, all states of South Sudan, even to grassroots. But now, even me, myself, I cannot go to my village. How can I reach grassroots in the village? Because of insecurity, all the roads is locked. You cannot go even the nearest place in Juba.
When the National Dialogues Steering Committee was sworn in late last month, it signaled the official launch of the dialogue. Grassroots, regional, and national meetings and consultations are expected to begin soon. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
South Sudanese refugees in the Bidibidi settlement camp in Uganda say they are going hungry after the UN's World Food Program cut monthly ratio of maize and sorghum. The refugees also say the delivery of cooking oil and other items are often delivered late. A Ugandan official say aid agencies cut the ratio because they are overwhelmed by the number of refugees fleeing violence in South Sudan. Tito Justin recently visited the settlement camp and has this report for VOA from Juba.
Bidibidi settlement camp has become the world's largest refugee camp, hosting more than about 350,000 refugees. Most of the refugees at the camp were displaced from former Central Equatorial State. Others fled violence in the former Western and Eastern Equatorial States. Betty Ropani and her family of 11 fled Yei Town last November to escape hunger and insecurity. She says men in military uniform blocked roads and she could not access the crops growing on her farm. Ropani says she does not receive enough food for her family, but it would help if the UN distributed ready-made flour instead of grains. Speaking in her native Kakwa language, she says after the UN's World Food Program's last food ratios to 12 kilograms per person, South Sudanese refugees began going hungry.
Karanga reduced it 14.
They reduced from 14 kilograms to 12 kilograms per person in a month. So in this family, it's not enough. At least if they keep the ration like it was before, that could be fair.
Refugee Viola Aputu, who also fled Yei Town last year, says when she and 8 family members arrived in Bidibidi, the food the UN provided was enough for the refugees, but not anymore.
The food cannot reach at the end of the month, and we are 8 in the family. With this population of the family, it gives us hard times to get a substitute food. If you don't struggle, you will not get.
Aputu says she earns a little money for buying food by working for families of the host communities. Another refugee, Agele Enos, fled Morobo County last year. Enos wishes there was enough land in Bidibidi so he could farm and produce his own food to supplement the relief food. He says he also worries about his kids' education.
The children who are studying here, they are reluctant. They have now said if that's the nature. Because out of it, you sell, you buy shop. Out of it, you sell, you have to buy uniform for your children. Out of it, you have to sell and also buy scholastic material for your children. We have decided, I personally have decided that if it has been reduced to 6, I have to really go back to South Sudan and suffer in my own land.
Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, or OPM, is responsible for refugee affairs in Uganda. Solomon Osakan is the OPM's refugee desk officer in West Nile. Osakan confirms the WFP's last food rations and there are often delays in delivering food to the refugees, but says aid agencies' resources are stretched thin by the sheer numbers of refugees arriving each day from South Sudan. Refugee Thomas Tongo lives with 8 family members in Bidibidi. Tongo was a teacher and an evangelist before he fled violence in Yei last year. He says the only way to prevent more suffering is to end the fighting so refugees can return to their homes.
The Bible says there is time for everything. Time for war is over. It is now time for peace. And we are tired of war. We have been growing a war since Anyanya 1, Anyanya 2. And up to date, we are still for war. And the issues of tribalism in South Sudan cannot help us develop. The nations have gone extra miles, and we are still in tribal wars, and we are still killing each other. So when we finish ourselves, who will inhabit the South Sudan land?
Tongo says the hundreds of thousands of refugees living in poor conditions in Ugandan camps must be given hope by their leaders that peace will be restored in their home country soon. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
South Sudan's education minister says Juba has reached a deal with the Zimbabwean government over stranded South Sudanese university students in Harare. 2 months ago, nearly 150 South Sudanese students were kicked out of several Zimbabwean universities after the government in Juba failed to pay their tuition and accommodation fees. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Minister Oral Yen Lam says he signed a joint communique with his Zimbabwean counterpart yesterday, in which the Zimbabwean authorities agreed to allow the students to take their exams late and continue their studies in the country.
There was a resolution from the Council of Ministers that if we are not able to pay it, the current arrears, that then the next plan should be the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Higher Education should be working out how this student to be returned back. But we are lucky enough, our yesterday meeting, we come with a good roadmap that may resolve to a solution and continuation of the student in Zimbabwe.
Lam says 148 South Sudanese students are studying various courses in Zimbabwean universities and colleges, including engineering and medicine. For those students, South Sudan owes the Zimbabwean institutions $1.4 million as the last 3 semesters were unpaid. Lam says he paid $500,000 to the Zimbabwe schools and Juba committed to pay the remaining balance by August. 25-year-old Gir Salfa confirms he and 27 other South Sudanese students at Harare Institute of Technology were allowed to move back to campus last Wednesday when South Sudanese officials gave school administrators a bank swift cut that would allow the school to receive some of the money owed to them. Salfa says the money came just as the students were trying to decide if heading back to South Sudan was the best option.
The government of Zimbabwe interfered and tried to make a good communication with us, saying that there is no need for us to be taken back. The money will be right paid in an installment. They have no problem with that. And that is the reason why the other universities, the problem now has been solved. Only our Institute of Technology is still having problems because they missed the exam.
Out of the 148 South Sudanese students attending universities across Zimbabwe, the 28 students at Harare Institute of Technology are the only ones who have missed their final exams. Salfa says the only outstanding issue now is negotiations between school and government officials about when or if the students can take exams, even though they have missed a significant amount of school.
We need the exam so that we can be promoted to the next semester. For example, me, myself, I'm going for attachment, so I need pass to clear these exams that I've missed in order for me to go forward. But what happened is the school board have not yet sat down, and the government of Zimbabwe there should be a communication from the Minister of Higher Education in Zimbabwe to our institute, so that telling the institute to allow us to go for exam, to be given a secure exam. But that communication is now still ongoing, because it was just yesterday when there was a communication between the two ministers.
Salfa says the students at Harare never registered for classes this year because of the money owed to the school. He says now that the school has some money, he is hopeful students like him will finally get to register for classes and sit for exams. An earlier agreement between South Sudan and Zimbabwe required Juba to pay $2,000 tuition fees for each student. Besides tuition fees, the deal also required that Juba pay feeding, accommodation, health insurance, and residence permit fees for the students. Lam says the new agreement reached yesterday waives other costs and requires Juba to pay tuition fees only.
We only remain with $2,000. That will be a comprehensive and inclusive everything. We will be only paying $2,000 for each student for a semester.
Lam says the new deal was reached after several meetings with the students, school administrators, and officials of the Zimbabwean government.
It was a good compromise between us and the government of Zimbabwe. We have come and managed to solve some of the problems that were facing the student, which will be presented to the Council of Ministers for further directives.
In April, the stranded South Sudanese students stormed the South Sudan embassy in Harare to protest Juba's failure to pay their fees. Today, most, if not all, of those students are feeling very relieved and grateful. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the latest update on Ebola in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what can be done to help street children find a better life?
We need to take care of them, build them schools, health facilities, and they can be more productive. They can be our future of tomorrow.
The right to education is something that must be a must, whether one can afford or cannot afford. So wherever they are, there must be opportunities for them.
We have to take street children to school, teach them good manners, give them all their basic needs.
We can take them off the street, train them, talk to them, and then try and educate families that they shouldn't give birth to children anyhow.
For them to have a better life, if we cannot provide shelter for them and you can even support them by giving them food, you have solved half of their problem.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Efforts to contain the Ebola outbreak in the remote northern Democratic Republic of Congo appear to be successful so far. No new cases have been reported, and the number of suspected cases is small. Four deaths have been reported in Basiwali province. Alison Clements Hunt is a spokesperson for World Health Organization's Outbreaks and Emergencies. She spent the past week in the Ebola zone. She gave VOA's Joe DiCapua an update on the outbreak.
So the latest situation is that we're still at two confirmed cases of Ebola and three probable. We haven't had any new confirmed cases since the 11th of May. So we're left with 12 suspect cases. All other suspect cases have now been declared negative by laboratory testing. If this continues and the rest of the suspect cases are negative, then it would appear that the outbreak is tailing off. But we have to keep up very rigorous surveillance until we can be sure of that.
How did the WHO and various health officials contain the outbreak?
We have a combination here of environment and response. The environment is incredibly remote, and I can attest to that. We're talking very dense equatorial forest. To get between the different areas is not easy. So, in fact, even to move suspect cases, for example, to a treatment unit would often not be feasible. So, therefore, in some ways, there could be a self-limiting effect that we've seen in previous outbreaks where the virus can't spread very easily, especially once people are ill. However, the other important factor is just the speed of the response. The Congolese authorities tested rapidly and then alerted WHO and other partners that there was an outbreak. This made it possible to respond quickly and to start following up, getting an emergency interagency emergency team out to the field with the Ministry of Health to start following up contacts and suspect cases. And in fact, the number of contacts now has come down dramatically as well to just 72 contacts still needing to be followed. That's down from over 500 on 600 initially.
Any idea how the first person became infected? Is it assumed that this person somehow either came in contact with bushmeat or ate bushmeat?
I wouldn't like to speculate, but certainly it seems to have been someone who would have been hunting and, again, was out in a remote area. So that would probably be a working hypothesis, yes.
So what happens now? Is it just a matter of wait and see to see whether the epidemic burns itself out?
Absolutely not. It's really important at this point to be extremely proactive. So we've made sure that all the small health centres dotted around the province are aware of how to recognise a suspect case. So every day, even now, there are regular alerts come in and then followed up by the different teams who go out to these areas and check on any potential suspect cases. And that's absolutely key to a rigorous surveillance system. Meanwhile, the epidemiological tracing is going on. There's epidemiologists working out there, biologists working there to trace exactly where this came from, where it spread to, and to see the trajectory of it. Because by understanding that, it can also mean that there could be a really rigorous examination of the chain of transmission to check that everyone who could possibly have been in that loop in any way or in contact has been found, has been seen, has been checked, and is not at risk or is not at risk of spreading the disease further.
So how long will you monitor those contacts, those people who may have been in contact with someone who was infected?
June the 2nd, which is tomorrow, is the date at which the last of the contacts will come out of their 21-day follow-up period. Now, that doesn't mean that we declare the outbreak over by any means. It's just that it means the contacts have been followed up for the required period, have been checked regularly.
Alison Clements Hunt is the spokesperson for WHO. She was speaking to VOA's Joe DiCapua from Kisangani in Northern Democratic Republic of Congo. Kenya launched a new Chinese-built railway this week aimed at connecting the port of Mombasa to the capital and ultimately to the rest of the East Africa region. VOA hopped aboard for the train's first journey. Mohammed Yusuf has the story from Nairobi with a reporting contribution from Amos Wangwa.
Passengers lined up to board the new train for its Negro run this week from Mombasa to Nairobi. The new railway cuts the journey from the key port city to the capital in half to about 5 hours.
Saizi unaweza ona katika yale masaa unaweza kuwa
passenger Zuberi Nete says kutoka Nairobi kwenda Mombasa, it will save time for us. The time you will be on the road will be shortened. For the business people, they will have a good opportunity to do their business. So with that, our economy will be able to grow and people will earn more. Kenyan national flags line the interiors of the cars as a smiling President Uhuru Kenyatta mingled with the passengers during the train ride. Kenyatta has made infrastructure development a cornerstone for his re-election bid in August. He said the train service puts Kenya on the path to industrialization.
This is the true beginning of our transformation journey. And ultimately, Kenyans from all corners will begin to see the benefit not just of this rail, but the ancillary activities that will develop as a result of us developing this spine as well as our continuation towards Port Kisumu.
The Mombasa-Nairobi line will carry both passengers and cargo. It cost $3.2 billion and took 2.5 years to build. It is part of a larger ongoing project, an East African railway network called the Standard Gauge Railway, that is being built and mostly funded by the Chinese. The plan is to continue the Mombasa line to Malaba in western Kenya and then onward to Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda and Burundi. Other branches will reach into South Sudan and Ethiopia. The lines will connect the landlocked countries with Kenya's two main ports, Lamu and Mombasa. Infrastructure development to open up East Africa is part of China's global Belt and Road strategy. Kenyatta secured an additional $3 billion from China to extend the rail line another 250 kilometers. The Export and Import Bank of China financed 90% of the Mombasa-Nairobi line. The government paid the other 10. A bank representative at the launch said they are ready to lend more to Kenya.
Relentless efforts of China Exim Bank to strengthen the partnership with African countries and enhance infrastructure connectivity in Africa. China Exim Bank values the long-standing friendly and cooperative ties with Kenya and stands ready to provide more financial support on the basis of mutual trust and mutual benefit.
Kenya's Transport Minister James Macharia says the rail line will boost the country's GDP by 1.5%. But some analysts are urging caution. Professor Chacha Nyaigoti Chacha specializes in diplomacy and international relations at the University of Nairobi.
The impact can be positive and negative. Negative in the sense that the credit, much as it is easily available, it may become very expensive to maintain. And because it is easily available, there is a temptation by African countries to overborrow or to overcommit themselves with Chinese companies or Chinese institutions. So that at the end of the day, then, it is like the continent might find itself having mortgaged itself to the Chinese.
The rail project has been clouded by accusations of corruption and concerns from conservationists that the line cuts through vital wildlife habitats. Kenya's opposition argued that the project was overpriced and the money would be better spent on improving basic services like healthcare. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song You Are One in a Million by Justin Simpleman. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
One in a million, you're better than them, my baby. I know you're one quid, one in a million, you're better than them, my baby. I know you're one quid, one in a million, you're better than them, my baby. I know you're one quid, one in a million, you're better than them, my baby. I know you're one quid, one in a million, you're better than them, my baby.
than